I'm going to tell you about condensed matter physics. We'll see how that goes. It's a very big field, and my main aim is really to give you a glimpse of the essential aspects of condensed matter physics that sort of gels with some of the other concepts you have been learning about in field theory and high energy physics and so on. And I notice it's a very international group and very international. I saw a little bit about you from your pictures, and I hope to learn more about you as we go on. What I'm going to do is typically the way I will organize my lectures is it's mainly going to be on the blackboard, and towards the end, I'm going to switch to a PowerPoint and show you some fun things about, like maybe experimental data. Or like today, I'll tell you a bit about quasicrystals. So something that connects with current day research, because one of the things you will see is that there are very general paradigms in condensed matter physics, but every so often they get broken, and that's why this field is so exciting, is that standard paradigms get broken, and that opens up avenues for people like you who are getting into the field to completely set a new stage. And I'll point it out again and again. This is a recurring theme in my lectures of how standard paradigms get broken, new ones are formed, and the story kind of goes on. But before we learn about broken paradigms, we have to learn what the paradigms are. So today I'm going to talk about crystal structures. That's the theme for today, and let me just write down the main topics. So today, I will talk about sort of the core ideas and then mainly talk about crystals. Okay, I abbreviate crystals by just X, shortens things. And the concepts we will emphasize here are Bravais lattices reciprocal lattices X-ray scattering or just scattering in general. And density correlations. Okay, and in the end, as I said, we will go do some fun things like maybe quasicrystals and okay. And you should feel free to stop me at any time and ask questions. I'm sure you are familiar with the physics of the very large astrophysics, looking at black holes and so on, and then physics of the very small, where literally you're trying to go inside the proton and look at ever higher energy scales and ever smaller structures. So that has been the traditional way we have gone about looking at things in physics. It's a reductionist view where you ask, what is this matter made of? And you say, oh, okay, it's made of protons and electrons. Well, what are electrons made of? What are protons made of? And you keep going downwards in a reductionist kind of view. Now, what condensed matter does, it takes a completely different point of view. In many ways, we know the Hamiltonian for the system. We know exactly what the interactions are. And they are typically Coulombic interactions between electrons. There are interactions between electrons and ions, and so on. So we know exactly what the Hamiltonian is, and yet we have not solved the problem. And the reason for this complexity is that there are many, many degrees of freedom. You're not talking about one or two atoms. you're talking about many atoms or many particles. So the core idea of condensed matter physics is emergence. It's the emergence of new degrees or new kinds of phases. Okay, so the idea is that you have sort of simple interactions between atoms, let's say just two-body interactions, and yet from these two-body interactions, because there are many particles, they end up organizing themselves in interesting ways. And it's the organization of these many objects that we call a phase. The phase is essentially an organization. And it's that concept that I want to build up in the course of these three lectures. So my lectures will essentially have a theme, and the general theme will be spontaneously broken symmetry. Let me even just say continuous symmetry, and we will see what these words mean in more detail. How that leads to phases, how these phases can be characterized in terms of sort of very simple properties about the excitations around the ground state. So the gold store, the collective modes, and how that leads to certain observable properties when you try to perturb these systems. So in the response, there could be some kind of a rigidity. Okay, so we'll see these very basic concepts getting correlated across different examples. And I'm going to take examples from crystals, from magnets, and from superconductors or superfluids. Okay, so this is not your traditional condensed matter physics that one typically learns from, that was previously taught. You know, somehow it was a field with a lot of detail, and it was very off-putting. You sort of very quickly delved into details of this a material has this kind of structure, something else has a different kind of structure. But really, there is a very beautiful and a very coherent point of view that goes across different systems that we talk about. So you can see that crystals, magnets, superconductors, on the face of it, look very different. But what connects them is that each of them will be an example of some kind of continuous symmetry that is broken. So in the crystals, we will see today, starting out in the gaseous phase, there is complete rotational and translational symmetry, right? An atom can be anywhere and in any location. But as you go toward a crystal, as you know, the atoms take on very specific positions. And there it is. That is the breaking of continuous rotational as well as translational symmetry. So that's the crystal. Now what you'll see in this course is that as a direct consequence of this breaking of symmetry, the low-lying excitations of these atoms have certain properties. They can have what are called phonons. These are long wavelength excitations. And moreover, an atom, for example, does not have a property like rigidity. You know that if I take the table and try to push it, it resists that push, so it is rigid. The atom did not have that property. So this is now the core idea of emergence. This property of rigidity did not exist in the atom. It is something which is emergent when you put many atoms together, and the collective behavior of these atoms has this kind of response. And the same thing we will see in magnets. You have spin rotational symmetry, which will get broken. The magnetic moment will now point in a particular direction. And this magnetic moment will have some kind of order from one atom to the next. That's the beginning of a phase, an ordered ferromagnetic phase. And again, just like the phonons, the atoms will have, these magnetic atoms can have low-lying spin excitations, spin waves. And it has also, like the rigidity of the crystal, it has something called a spin stiffness. So you'll see that emerge in the sort of the later lectures. And superconductors are now examples of broken gauge symmetry. So we'll try to understand what is this gauge symmetry, how a superconductor breaks that, and what are the consequences of that. Okay, so that's kind of the overview of where I'm heading. So let me start out today with just the crystal. And I think I'm definitely going to have fun with all this. Let's move that up. Okay. So let us try to be concrete and start with crystals. Okay, so to begin with, let's put down some temperature here. And this is temperature. Let me make it high on this side. So this is the temperature. And as you know, at high temperatures, there is a gaseous phase. At some lower temperature, you have a liquid. And you know, we know this from experience. And at low temperatures, you get a crystal. Now, this, of course, these two phases, as I said, are rotationally and translationally symmetric. And the crystal, on the other hand, breaks these symmetries, breaks both symmetries. Yes, question?
You mean rotating a single atom or the whole structure?
What I mean is that, yeah, so in this case, if I look at the system at any, suppose I'm sitting at some vantage point R, okay, and I go and I look in some direction here versus there, the behavior at all these points is identical in a gas. So suppose I was looking at the density of the gas at different points, and I look out, like in this room, I look out and I look at this point or that point or any point, the density everywhere is identical, and it's a constant density. Okay? Good, yeah, so keep asking these questions. So now I might ask you, what is the difference between a gas and a liquid? You know, how do you think there's a difference between a gas and a liquid? How would you make that distinction? You know, both are rotationally and translationally symmetric, but if I, you know, we know a liquid is different. And how would you, characterize that difference?
The distance between harder to compress.
Pardon?
Compressibility.
Pardon?
Compressibility.
Yes, it is much more compressible. Much less compressible in the liquid compared to the gas. So clearly what is happening is the interactions between the atoms is starting to play a role. So when I say temperature is high or low, I must compare that scale with something. And that scale is an interaction scale. So I can write down a Hamiltonian for this, which is something like a sum of pair potentials. There, and then this is some pair potential phi of rij. Okay, R. So essentially, what I have is I have to put some kind of interaction between the atoms. Let's say it's some phi of r, and it will typically have some behavior of this kind. This is zero. This is some equilibrium distance r zero, and here is, let's say, the potential energy at the minimum. So this is some pair potential between two atoms.
It will typically have some behavior which is very repulsive at short distances, somewhat attractive at distances on the order of what defines the interparticle spacing, and this attraction typically comes from van der Waals interactions. So we don't need to go into those details. This is some general form for the interactions. And from such a Hamiltonian, we can calculate what is Rij, Ri, and J just are the positions of the atoms. Okay. So given a Hamiltonian, as you know from your statistical physics class, you can calculate what is the energy. So the average energy, U, will just be, how would I do that? I would just find out the partition function and from that get U. So U is essentially going to be of the form, I would sum over all the configurations, e to the minus beta, sorry, beta sort of H, beta H, and then this depends on Ri, and then times H of Ri, divided by the partition function. Okay, so you don't need to know it in detail, but essentially this Hamiltonian for a given configuration, so what I mean by Ri is a given configuration, R1, Rn, okay, I mean a given configuration of atoms, I take that, and for that given configuration, I can calculate this phi for every pair of atoms, add it all up, weight it by the Boltzmann factor, here beta is nothing but the inverse temperature, and weight it by the Boltzmann factor, and that's how I can get my U, which is the energy, or the interaction energy. So you can see that the temperature enters in the calculation of U, and it weights the configurations that will contribute to this sum. Now, how it plays out in this picture is that you have to look at, in this case, temperatures which are much, much greater than U. That's where it's a true gas, where it doesn't feel the interactions. As the temperature becomes on the order of U, you start to feel the interactions, the system becomes incompressible, but yet there is no broken symmetry at that point. When you get to temperatures much, much less than U, that's when you see this very special thing happening where the atoms take on specific positions. So atoms occupy specific positions. Now, why does it do that? So why broken? Why is this breaking of symmetry? Anybody wants to take a stab at that? Why should a system which had the full symmetry of the Hamiltonian go into a state with a lower symmetry? Did you, in your statistical physics class, you probably saw this in action in the Ising model, right? At high temperatures, you have, that's a discrete symmetry. A spin can be up or down. And at high temperatures, essentially the entropy was winning. And the system was in a completely symmetric state with both up and down states. The system was not magnetized. As you cool the system, essentially, there's a fight between the energy U and the entropy. So what is driving this whole transition is the system is trying to minimize the free energy. F, which is U minus TS. And at high temperatures, it tries to maximize the entropy. And that's why it takes up all possible positions, all possible spin states, and so on. It's in a completely random
state like a gas or a liquid. Once you go to low temperatures, say zero temperatures, now the entropy plays no role and the system is essentially being determined by the minimum total energy U. And depending on the interactions, it now then goes into a crystal state. So it's really the minimizing of this free energy that drives this approach to an ordered state. Now, unlike the Ising model, where there were just two possibilities, here there are an infinite number of possibilities, and that's why we call it a broken continuous symmetry. So in other words, when the atoms form a lattice, it could have, the first atom could have decided to sit in any of the infinite number of choices. But once it sits in a particular location, here, the position of the next one is determined exactly by the lattice constant. So let me just call it A, which is related to R naught, but it is the position of the next one is dictated just by the interactions in the system. And that's the symmetry breaking. Okay, so in this course, the approach to this ordered phase is really a matter of understanding statistical mechanics and the available states. What we are going to talk about is really the zero temperature structure and the behavior at zero temperature, the nature of this ordered phase, and then its low-lying excitations at low temperatures. So let me move to that. Okay, so now another important notion when we have phases is how do we characterize these phases? And the notion of the order parameter. Okay, so clearly we know in our minds what we want to do. We want to describe the ordering of these atoms. So it's like a density modulation which is becoming periodic. So in our minds we know what we want to do. We want to define an operator which deals with the density. So here is the density operator. Okay, so what I'm doing here is this is the point at which density is being measured or calculated, whatever it is. And so essentially what you're doing is you have your system, you're going around and you're checking. Is there anything at R? And you look at all the positions R sub I of the atoms, and if there is any density there, then you get a hit, and then you get a counter. And that's the density operator. And we know that in the gas or liquid, this operator, if I take its expectation value, again, by the average, what I mean is, this is a statistical average. So it's a quantity just like the total energy U, where instead of H of Ri, which was the energy of each configuration, I now look at the density of each configuration, weighted by the Boltzmann factor, and evaluate it. Right? You're all familiar with this? Yeah. And this quantity is just going to be a constant, as we discussed. So this is a constant. Okay. And in a crystal, on the other hand, N of R is going to be, the atoms take on specific positions, so this is going to be R minus R sub I. So these R sub I are called Bravais okay, those are the specific positions that the atoms are sitting at. And they are called the Bravais lattice positions. Now, let me just go and Fourier transform both sides. So here, let me make a lattice here. So these are my R sub I's. This is the ith atom here, and this is R sub I. Okay, so let me Fourier transform both sides, and what I get is N of R e to the I q dot R dr. And this is defined to be N of Q. And on the other side, when I do the Fourier transform, you can see I will get something like, okay, let me do one more step. I can do the integral, take the sum out, and what I'm going to be left with is the sum over I e to the I q dot r I. So, question? Yes, at any finite temperature, it would be a statistical average. So, and then these RIs, so I should put a little caveat here. Let me just say crystal at T equal to zero. Okay? So at any finite temperature, I should not just write RI. It's not a fixed position. It should be a vector which is moving in time. And we will come to that when we look at the crystal at finite temperatures. Okay, so if I look at the crystal at T equal to zero, Ri are the definite, are the fixed Bravais lattice positions. So they won't change in time, and then I don't have to do a statistical average here. Okay, but yes, if I wanted to describe the crystal at any finite temperature, I would have to put that statistical average. Okay, so what we are trying to do is, we are trying to understand there is a periodic structure. And of course, I could write, this is another theme which you will see going through condensed matter all the time. We constantly go into wave vector space and frequency space. And the reason for that is that if there is some kind of density structure, you want to distill that structure out in terms of what are the wavelengths that describe these density modulations? So clearly, if I took the gas or the liquid and I did a Fourier transform of that uniform density, what would it be in K space? Pardon? Yes, it would be a delta function at Q equal to zero. So if I did the same Fourier transform, I would just get a delta function at Q equal to zero, which says, to describe this uniform density, I don't need to tell you where every atom is. In Q space, all I need to say is there's only a single mode that is required to describe this uniform density, and that's Q equal to zero. Now, for the crystal, what you get is that that periodic density pattern can be described by N of Q, which involves these modes in a particular way. And this sum is going to be, what you will see is you're adding all these phases from coming from the different atoms. And these different phases in general will cancel unless q dot ri is an 2 pi times an integer. And then they will all add coherently. So this is basically, so let me, before I write that answer there, let us do a little example here in 1D. So let's do a 1D example. Okay, so in 1D, you can see that if I had a crystal, let me say Rj was equal to J times A. Yes, and J is an integer. So J belongs to an integer. And if I do this Fourier transform in 1D, this is going to be sum over I from 1 to, let me take 0 to sum over J from 0 to N minus 1. E to the I Q J A. That's why I switched to J, because there's an I, which is our iota. And this is nothing but E to the I Q N A minus 1 over E to the I Q A minus 1. OK, and up to phase factors, which are not important, this goes like sine Q N A over 2 divided by sine Q A over 2. Can you see up there? Or should I be using the boards a little differently? Can you see in that corner? OK. And so you can see that N of Q diverges when Q A is equal to 2 pi times an integer. And m is, again, an integer. Right? So precisely at certain wave vectors, q, such that it is equal to 2 pi over 8 times an integer, the denominator diverges. And what we get then is sort of sine x over x. And you can basically see that you will get at those points, n of q will go like, will be equal to n delta q, 2 pi over a times m. Right? So you'll get a delta function of strength n at precisely those wave vectors. And those special wave vectors are given a name. So these things are called, so you can define, tell me if I'm going too far. You can define a reciprocal lattice vector G, which is 2 pi m over a. OK, so what you find is that the pardon? Yeah, right now I just did it in 1D. So I have just a point. Yeah, but in general, it's a vector, and it will have components in all the dimensions. And I will define it formally. Yeah. But I want to give you the idea that what has happened is when you had a uniform density, the Fourier transform produced a pattern with just a delta function at q equal to 0. When you have a periodic structure, the Fourier transform produces a delta functions here, so which have a strength n, and it has delta functions at q, comma, g, which I'm going to define. In 1D, we have defined it, but essentially this g is defined by, so g is called a reciprocal lattice vector, and it's defined by G dot R equal to 2 pi times m, where m belongs to an integer. OK, so this is one very powerful result which says that you will get sort of coherent effects at
equal to g. And I will make it a little more concrete what I mean by coherence when I discuss a scattering experiment. But the basic idea is this, that the density modulation produces structure in wave vector space, which has very sharp peaks or coherences at specific values of q, which are equal to 2 pi over the lattice spacing times an integer. What you're seeing is the generation of another lattice in reciprocal space. That there was this lattice that we had here, and it had a certain lattice constant A, and this was in real space lattice. And what we have seen is that from this density pattern, the real space lattice had a density pattern N of R, which was sum over I from 1 to N, delta R minus R. Minus Ri. And what you're seeing is that there is a K space or a Q space lattice. Which is basically N of Q. And that is N delta Q comma G. And that has a structure now. It's in Q space. I can actually show it at the same spacing. I just have to define my unit. And this distance now is 2 pi over A. Okay. Yes.
When you define G, which R is it? Because we introduced the Ri's, which are the Breville lattice
yes.
vectors, but this R is the R point of view vector, or?
No, this is the R's are just the lattice position.
Okay, so is it J?
So R, you can call it Rj in 1D.
Mm-hmm.
R sub, I called it, instead of I shifted to J because I had to do e to the I cube
yeah.
dot something. But R sub I would just be I times A. It's an integer times A, which tells you the position of the ith atom. So in other words, in this lattice, this is my lattice spacing, and I have some origin somewhere, right? I have an origin somewhere. I go to the ith atom, right? So this is my ith atom. So actually, the best thing is you can use your origin to be one of the atoms, OK? You can use as your origin to be one of the atoms, and then from here, the ith atom here, this is the ith atom, will be R sub I, which is I times A. Okay?
Then my question is more that we have N of those vectors.
Yes.
So is there N J vectors?
Yes.
Okay, that's
There are N, so your lattice positions, and I will do that more formally, your lattice positions, there are N of them. And you will see similarly in your reciprocal space also, I should label them with G of n. And this little n will also be an index which takes on n values. OK, but first, OK, is that clear? I will write that more carefully. But I want you to first get this very basic idea of why we are going into Q space, because we are trying to extract the modulation of the density through the wavelengths that describe that modulation. Okay.
And so now we are, you know, remember what we were trying to do was to find out how we can characterize these phases. What is an order parameter? And so now we are almost there because we can see that if I use, so the order parameter, for a crystal is now very clear because we can see that if I look at G's, so these G's in 1D, so let me say in 1D, just we are going to still try to use our intuition with 1D. R sub I is, let's say, I times A, and G sub, and I belongs to an integer, and G sub M is m times 2 pi over a, where m belongs to an integer. Okay? So except for q equal to 0, if I look at any other value of q, there will be no structure in a liquid or a gas, right? So there we have an order parameter. An order parameter is basically a quantity which is 0 in the disordered phase, like the liquid or the gas, but is non-zero in the ordered phase. So here it is. We have an order parameter, and that is n of g. So we look at n of g not equal to 0. OK, so that is our order parameter. And essentially, this n of g is going to look like this. If I divide it by n, right, because it's of order n, which is a big number, then it is of order n. So I divide it by that. So it's 1 here. This is temperature. And it sort of decreases. And at some point, there's a phase transition. And it goes into the disordered phase. So this is the crystal. And this is the liquid. And so on. OK? And yes.
It's a group on lattice vector depends on this capital R, which means that it depends on the origin of depends on this vector R capital, which depends on the origin from where I.
The capital R is, are you talking about the lattice, the Bravais lattice?
Yeah, the capital R, the vector, capital R.
Yes, it does depend on that.
And this depends on from where I choose my origin in the lattice, right?
The origin is not important. I'm just defining the positions to be some vector r. Okay, that's the capital R that I'm talking about. Based on capital R, so I'll write down a formal definition in 3D in just 1 minute, and then ask me a question again at that point. Okay, so this becomes our order parameter. It is basically the strength of that delta function. That delta function strength is equal to n, because at zero temperature, all the n atoms are coherently scattering. But at any finite temperature, the number of atoms that will be coherent will reduce. And so this number starts going down. And you know, this is more of a detail. At some point, it goes to zero, and it can either go through to zero continuously, like this. This would be a continuous phase transition. As happens in, say, the Ising model, this is temperature. This is some Tc. This is the order parameter. This is in some other system, not here. And this would be called a continuous phase transition. Here there is a jump, and that is basically what is called a first order phase transition. Now, I'm not going into details of why and when it is continuous or first order. That's takes us into a different direction. But all I wanted to give you an idea first is how does one go about from the structure defining an order parameter that characterizes the crystal? And you know, essentially, its temperature dependence will then tell us about phase transitions. So in this course, where we are focused on is really the behavior at zero temperature and close to it. That's going to be our region of exploration here. Okay, so now we are ready to make some formal definitions, and that will clear a lot of these questions. So let me do that. Okay, so let's bring that up. So I'm trying to keep it organized, like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and now this is the sixth panel. So we come to the geometry. Yes.
What is the one-dimensional Euclid?
You mean, do they exist?
Yeah. I mean, well, we do not have one-dimensional anything, but
what? Oh, not true. You'll see, okay, this is actually fascinating. This is the part that really is very exciting for a theoretical physicist. You know, you saw how quickly I went to 1D. Because a lot of the essential things can be discussed in 1D. And then you can, you know, put more vector signs and go to higher dimensions. And your question is, do they ever exist? And so a lot of my research is in these ultra-cold atoms. And one of the things, I'll tell you more about it as the course evolves, but one of the things that is possible to make are artificially make one-dimensional either crystals or structures by different kinds of fabrication techniques. So while we may not be interested in how exactly our wonderful experimental colleagues achieve that, we are interested in the fact that you can make an exactly one-dimensional Tonks gas or Tonks, you know, these interacting Bose gases in 1D, Luttinger liquids in 1D, which are fermions in 1D, these can be made. And they can be made truly one-dimensional, so you can see all the deviations from standard theories that exist in higher dimensions. So we'll hear more about that.
Okay, but so what's a one-dimensional liquid? I mean, because in the liquid, the distance between atoms is something.
So one-dimensional liquid would be, say, I take n atoms, mm-hmm. and if I put them randomly anywhere.
Well, that's a gas.
That's a gas. Yeah. Then if I now turn on interactions, they will not just sit randomly, they will show some correlations. Okay, that would be a 1D liquid. Okay, I will say more about a liquid later in terms of higher order correlations. Right now I have stuck at the density level. And at the level of just the density, the liquid and gas are both uniform. And the crystal is the one that has this ordered structure. To see the difference between a liquid and a gas, you have to go to a higher order correlation function between the density. And then you can tell whether it is truly a gas, completely random, versus a structure that shows some recognition of the interparticle interaction. Okay, so. Okay, so the geometry of crystal lattices. So basically, a Bravais lattice, as we have already been using this concept, is all points R sub I, which are of this form, Ni, Ai, I going from 1 to D. D is the dimension. Okay, so so it's basically a periodic array. Sorry, and here I should write that AI are called the primitive vectors. And they must, in order to generate the lattice in D dimensions, they must be linearly independent. And that means they cannot all lie in the same plane, right? Because then you are not going to be able to describe this lattice in a unique way. Okay, so, and the other thing is, so it's a periodic array of repeated so to say, repeated units. And this unit could be an atom or a group of atoms and so on. It doesn't matter. This can is sometimes also called a basis. Okay, now I'm sorry?
In your summation, which I sum?
Oh, I should use a different notation here. R sub alpha. So for example, in three dimensions, there will be three vectors. Okay? A alpha will take on three.
It's still the same.
The sum is over.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, I think this is correct. This is a three. This is not running over all the atoms. This is running over.
There's no three in this.
Yeah. So you should have Ri and then maybe Ni alpha.
Yeah, that's what I mean. So I should have an index for an atom, and then I want Ni alpha. This is for the atom index, and A alpha is really my XYZ. Yeah, thank you. Is that okay? No? Yeah. Okay, and so for example, let me just draw it in 2D. So now you can see I have progressed to 2D. And you can see right away that these AIs are not independent, are not unique. So for example, I could have picked this as one set of, let's say, A1 and A2. Or I could have picked something like another possibility could have been this and this. This could have been A1 and A2. Okay. So in general, they have to be linearly independent, but they are not unique. Okay. And so we have this periodic repetition of a unit. So by that I mean this could have been an atom, it could have been a more decorated stuff here, but that stuff, whatever it is, that motif is repeated. That's the point of it. And the motif can be complicated. Okay, and now the unit cell is basically the volume of space which are transported by these R's belonging to a Bravais lattice, basically generates the whole lattice. What I want to say is fills all the space. With no voids. Okay, so something like this would be a unit cell. This would be a unit cell. I can similarly make a unit cell there, and I transport this, and as I translate it by R, and it fills all space with no voids. And now I'm coming to that. So this is any unit cell, but then in particular, there is a primitive unit cell, which is the smallest such cell. Okay, so this is a unit cell with one Bravais lattice point. Okay, so these are some definitions one can go through. I would suggest you should look at the textbook Ashcroft and Merman and get more of these formal definitions. The point is of my bringing it up here is we will see interesting lattices like the graphene lattice. And you will see that in some of these lattices, the need for making these definitions more precise. So when we get to that, it becomes more interesting to bring that into the discussion. But okay, in any case, we can define this geometry, and from here, we have the definition of a primitive unit cell, which has only one Bravais lattice point. And there's one more concept I need to bring up, what is called a Wigner sites primitive cell. And this is basically a unit cell. It's a primitive unit cell. So each one is one further restriction. It's a primitive unit cell with all the symmetries. Symmetries of the lattice, of the Bravais lattice. Okay, and there is a particular way in which one can generate that. I'm not going to go through that here, but I will put up some notes and you can get more of those details of how to generate these for different structures. It's not totally illuminating to just do it here. I want to really stress some of the concepts. So from here, basically what we see now is, let me bring this down. Okay, so that's the real space structure, and let's go to the reciprocal lattice. So given a Bravais lattice, R sub I, all of these points, we can construct another lattice. Construct another lattice in Q space such that e to the I Q dot R is equal to e to the I Q dot R plus R. Okay, sometimes I don't put the subscript here, R sub I, and that's to be understood. R is just any set of Bravais lattices like this, right? So we have our generating vectors or basis vectors A sub alpha, and we can take linear combinations of that, you know, adding different integers and construct all possible Bravais lattice vectors R. So sometimes I put the subscript, sometimes I don't, but you should take it to mean the entire set of these Bravais lattice vectors. So I want to construct another lattice in Q space, and these Q, so they are denoted by G and satisfy e to the I G dot R is equal to 1 for all R belonging to Bravais lattice. Okay, and we can construct such the G's, and the solution is that these G's are given by sum over MJ. Sorry, let me now be careful about my notation. Let me call it M beta B beta. Okay, and again, I can put a label here, GI, if I want, okay? And these Bs, so for example, B1 is of this form, 2 pi, so I should say here these Ms are integers. these b's are 2 pi a2 cross a3, for example, b1, a1 dot a2 cross a3. So that's the volume element in the denominator. And here I have the two other directions. If I'm looking at b1, I have the two other directions, a2 cross a3. And similarly, you can define b2 and b3. Right? Now, right away, by plugging it in, you can see that when I take the dot product with R, you will see that basically this will give me a1 dot a2 cross a3, which will cancel, and I will be left with 2 pi times integers coming either from the integer values of G or the integer values representing R. But 2 pi times any integer is, you know, will give me a phase factor here, e to the I 2 pi, which will be 1. Right? So this is a very general way of constructing the reciprocal lattice for any given real space lattice. So does that answer your question? You had a question about the connection between R and G. This is the connection.
Arbitrariness, because it's still, I don't know how we choose the origin, like from where we measure a1 and a2 and a3, the origin.
You can pick any origin. It doesn't matter, right? You can pick any origin.
But if I have a specific point here and I choose the origin from here and find this vector g and change the origin, I will find another vector g.
Yeah, so it doesn't matter. Your specific values will matter. So, you know, these n's, I should say, take on both positive and negative values.
So yeah. the point is that we assume that there is a lattice vector at the origin.
Yes.
Yeah. So that reduces the arbitrariness.
Yes, there is a lattice vector at the origin. Is that? I'm not really sure what where your confusion is. But it doesn't matter where I choose my origin. It can be chosen anywhere, and with respect to that, then you can construct your, you know, of course these expansion vectors or the basis vectors, you know, it doesn't matter where you pick your origin, but once you have your lattice site, as was just said, you pick one of the atoms to be your origin, and then with respect to that, you can define all of them with using integers which are both positive and negative. Okay, so this then gives us a way to construct the reciprocal lattice. Okay, and what you notice is a few things which are kind of interesting, that the reciprocal lattice is itself also a Bravais lattice. You can go through the same definition there and see that this lattice that got constructed in Q space is also a reciprocal lattice. And if I take the reciprocal of that lattice, it just goes back to becoming the original lattice. Yeah. Do you have a question? No.
Yeah. I had a question. This is only for three dimensions.
This is for three dimensions, but you can also make it in two dimensions. You can pick A3 to be the z direction, and then you can construct it in two dimensions as well.
In higher dimensions. What about higher dimensions?
Oh, I've actually never thought about higher dimensions, but that's something we should think more about. That's something we should think more about. I have typically stayed within 3, 2, 1. I'm happy to go to low dimensions. That's something that would be worth thinking about. But basically, there's nothing restricting. It's just a matter of defining it. But there has to be a reciprocal lattice in any dimension. Okay? Because once you have a lattice in D dimensions, the point about the reciprocal lattice are just the wave vectors you need to expand it in. And that has to also be a lattice in the same d dimensions. Okay, now one more thing I want to stress, and that is, why are we constantly going into k space or q space? And the reason for that is that there is a very deep connection of these Fourier transforms with how you would see these crystals, how you would measure these properties. So. One cannot be moved. I didn't realize, but this is the immovable one. Let me come here.
Okay, so I am running a little bit out of time, so let me go a little quickly here. But basically, what I want to bring in are these X-rays, which is the way you would try to see these crystals. And it's a very quick estimate you can make for why we need X-rays. So typically, the system you would have is, here is your system. And one would come in with, say, X-rays with some momentum k. Now, this is k I'm putting. So k is the initial momentum. And it interacts. So the X-rays are basically electromagnetic waves. They interact with the charge density of the system, right? So it will, X-rays will couple. These are electromagnetic waves. And they basically couple to the charge density. So all these things that we've been talking about, these atoms are sitting at particular locations. We were only worrying about the structure. But what it interacts with is the charge profile or the charge distribution at each site. And as a result of that coupling, the X-rays get scattered and go off in another direction. OK, so they go off in another direction. Now, we are going to assume, in general, the system could take up. So the system takes up momentum. So momentum transferred is q, which is k prime minus k. That's the momentum that got transferred to the crystal. And in general, you could also have energy transfer, right? The system could take up energy, and that'll be the next topic we will come to. When the crystal oscillates at finite temperature, it can actually absorb energy from the crystal. But right now, let us assume it's elastic scattering. And that means the energy is conserved. And so what I have is, so as a result, my energy here, let's say mod k, is equal to 2 pi over lambda. The wavelength does not shift. It's just the direction that changes. So from that very simple thing, one can show that, you know, you can show that if your scattering is elastic, here is k. Here is k prime. And this vector here is q. And if this is theta, this is 2 theta. And you can just show very generally that q, which is mod q, is 2k, 2k sine theta. OK, so it gives us a relation between the initial, between the momentum that you are coming in with and the angle. And the point that we have been making is that when you look at the scattering, so this is where it becomes very concrete. When we look at the scattering, for most angles, there is nothing. There's complete destruction because of the interference from the different atoms. Only at specific values of q, this q is the same q I had been using in the previous discussion. Only at specific values of q, which equal the reciprocal lattice vectors, do you suddenly get these very sharp peaks. And that's the scattering intensities that people observe. Yes? We are talking about, this is a big crystal. Okay, so in general, the momentum taken up by the crystal is, it's not going to really move the crystal. So it's like a hard ball. You know, you think of a wall. Think of this wall. I hit a ball on the wall, and the ball just changes its direction. That's the thing. So the energy transfer is minimal. You can ignore it. Okay, and you can work out these some numbers here that if I look at energy of an X-ray, which is, you know, let's say about 1 keV, then you can convert that into lambda. So you can write down E is equal to h nu, which is hc over lambda. And from here, you can find that lambda that you get for an energy, for an X-ray of 1 kilovolt energy is about 10 to the minus 9 meters, which is 1 nanometer. And that's exactly the atomic scale. Okay, so that's why, that is the reason behind using X-rays. If you have some other structure, you have to find an appropriate wave to interact with it. And you know, you might well be thinking of higher dimensions. You're interacting with, I don't know, different types of radiation. So you have to basically pick your radiation to probe the wavelengths you want to see. That's the point of this. OK. Now, I want to do one more thing, which is to describe the, and I'm kind of running a little out of time here. So OK, I think maybe what I will do is skip some of these things. And so here, let me just recap. And then I want to show you some PowerPoint slides on some of the newer stuff. So let me recap a few things here. So the last part of the story, which I'm going to talk a little quickly here, is that basically when you look at a scattering event from K to K prime, this will involve matrix elements between K and the potential that you are seeing, some V and K prime. Okay? And this V, what is V? V will basically be And this V of R is essentially going to be some little U atom. This is U atom R minus RI. Let me put down RI. And if I put in complete sets of states here, what this will amount to is essentially from here, if I put this behavior for the potential and I evaluate this matrix element, I'm essentially going to get U atom Q times let me in fact just keep it general here. Let me just say R sub I. OK? So what I have done is I've said that when I do this scattering process, it interacts with the potential V of R at some point R. And that potential is made up of these atomic potentials sitting at specific sites R sub I. These are typically Bravais lattice positions, but in general, the theory works even for a crystal, even for a liquid or a gas. So R sub I's could be any position. So when I put this matrix element in, I'm not showing you all the algebra, but I would put in these complete sets of states. And then K and R will give me a plane wave state, e to the I k dot R. K prime and R will give me e to the I k prime dot R with a minus sign. And I will end up getting e to the I q dot r, where q is just k prime minus k. Okay? So essentially what you're seeing is that when the X-ray interacts with this atomic potentials, it generates a Fourier transform of that potential. And it has two parts. One is just coming from the atom, and the other is the structural part. So this is the part that is coming from the structure. And really the intensity of the scattering is now going to be proportional to this matrix element square, and that will be of the form n times vq, u atom q mod square times this structural information I'm going to define to be n of q, which I had done earlier, times n of q, n of minus q, and I'm going to put this thing just to, for a general statistical average. Okay, and I've put an n factor there, and I'm going to put in 1 over n here. Okay. So what you're seeing is that the intensity has a part which is just coming from n atoms that would have anyway been scattering incoherently. But then there is a structural part which picks up this modulation in the density. N of q, n of minus q, this is coming from the mod square. And I've made it more general, if I was at finite temperatures, I would be evaluating the statistical average. So something like this. And this is often called the structure factor. Okay, and we can see what it looks like in some of the data. Okay, so I think if I can have the screen down. Yeah. Okay, so while this is coming up, let me just recap. I tried in the beginning to give you a little broad idea about just to connect with statistical physics that you would have done before, how you, as you reduce the temperature, the system then undergoes this spontaneous breaking symmetry and takes up specific positions. And those specific positions are what we call the Bravais lattice. And the point about the Bravais lattice is if you do a scattering experiment, you essentially, because of the scattering from k to k prime, the difference, which is the vector q, you essentially probe the system on the scale of q. So you're essentially asking, what are the wave vectors that define my density distribution in the system? So directly, you're probing the Fourier transform and measuring, essentially, the structure factor S of q. And I want to show you very quickly, just so we have a picture of how it looks like in the liquid phase, which we talked about. So in the gas, if I try to measure the density, it's a constant. If I try to measure the next order effect, which is given an atom here, what's the probability of finding another atom a certain distance away? It's completely random. It's completely uniform in a gas. But in a liquid, if I have an atom here, because of the hardcore repulsion coming from phi of r, there will be some region where you won't find another atom. So that's this excluded region. And then, this quantity has some structure. We don't need to go into the details of that. I just wanted to show you that in a liquid, you distinguish it from a gas by looking at these higher order pairing correlations. And if I then go on to calculate the structure factor, which is that quantity S of q, it's just e to the I q dot ri, that's n of q, n of minus q average. It looks like this. So at q equal to 0, there is a delta function which has been removed. Okay, so that would have been the only structure in a gas, that very large delta function at q equal to 0. In a liquid, in addition, you see these very big peaks, but the whole thing is of order 1. It's a number like 3 or whatever it is. In the crystal, what happens is these same peaks take on now, become very large of order n. This is trying to say that the liquid is starting to become coherent on the scale of a few atoms. So you see some structure. It's kind of giving you a hint into as to what the state is going into. When you become a, when the system becomes a crystal, now you get these very sharp peaks that we have been talking about at the reciprocal lattice vector, and these peaks are of order n, because all the n atoms are contributing. So that was that factor of n that I was manipulating there. Okay, so that is one thing I wanted to tell you about. And this is now a typical scattering from something like silicon. It doesn't matter. Any crystal would have a very sharp set of patterns that you know, really define the crystal. And these points at which you see these scatterings are really the reciprocal lattice vector. OK, the next thing. OK, so I think I should end here. Let me, I'll put some notes up on this later, but let me just end by telling you about this last part, which is the quasicrystals. So, you know, there will be some kind of a homework problem where we will discuss what are possible rotational symmetries you can have and still tile a let's say, two-dimensional structure periodically. Okay, what kind of rotations can you have? And you'll see that you can have four-fold rotations or six-fold. But five-fold is forbidden. And there's a very simple calculation you can do, and I'll make that into a nice homework problem. So based on that, there is the general understanding or general paradigm that you can't have five-fold symmetries and periodically and tile, let's say, a floor with some regular shape, a regular pentagon. And yet, in 1984, there was this amazing experiment done by Schechtman and other collaborators. And Schechtman went on to get the Nobel Prize for Chemistry this year for this very discovery. And in that discovery, they found a five-fold symmetric diffraction pattern, okay, in some alloy. And this is what the data looked like. So here's the data. So if you look at it, you'll see 10 spots. If you start counting, you'll see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 around the central one. Okay, so that's coming from five-fold rotations and inversion. Okay, so essentially this was a proof that you are seeing five-fold rotational pattern. And it completely destroyed all the paradigms that existed at that time. And initially people argued a lot by saying, well, maybe these are not very precisely sharp. Because if it was totally periodic, you realize we would have gotten delta functions. So they tried to discuss it in the context of maybe these are not very sharp, so it doesn't break that paradigm. But all that was worked out. And theoretically, it was understood that you could have quasi-periodic sequences using not just one pattern, but two distinct unit cells. So I should not call them unit cells, two distinct structures were used, let's say a fat polygon and a thin polygon. And you needed two such structures to tile the whole two-dimensional plane or three dimensions. You can do this in any dimension. And with that, they were able to construct exactly that pattern using such a structure. So the old paradigm was that when you see sharp spots, it must imply that there is some kind of translational symmetry, as we have discussed today, or vice versa. If you have translational symmetry, it implies that you have sharp spots. It goes both ways. But what this new discovery made us realize is that sharp spots need not come from translational symmetry. This argument only works one way. Translational symmetry always gives sharp spots. But sharp spots can come even when you don't have translational symmetry, such as this quasi-periodic order. Yeah, OK, so that's it. So that brings me to the end of today's lecture. And tomorrow I will talk about lattices, which are starting to move, and the so-called Goldstone modes. OK, thank you.